the field, turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to this Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, flying solo for the next hour here, at least in terms of the hosting duties, as JT, Pontiff of the Pick Four, off to enjoy some family time here on this Thanksgiving weekend, and a very active and busy edition of Trainer Talk coming your way here over the course of the next hour. Trainer Mark Cassie going to join us momentarily. He'll be with us for the first half hour of the show, and then Al Stahl Jr. with us in the second half. And we remind you that podcasts of all of our Trainer Talks are available right now on our website, horseracingradio.net. You can go back, listen to the show at your leisure. If you missed any portion of the interviews, you can go back and do that whenever you like at horseracingradio.net. And we do welcome all of you just joining us on Sirius Channel 93, and of course, all of you who have been with us all along since 3 o'clock Eastern on XM 209. And without further ado, the man who has won nearly 1,500 races for his career, the 51-year-old born on Valentine's Day of 1961, he's trainer Mark Cassie. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. You've done some research.
Well, yeah, it wasn't hard. The whole Valentine's Day thing I thought was kind of neat. You have the same birthday as my sister, so.
Oh, really? Well, very good.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the show, and looking forward to hearing your story over the course of the next half an hour or so. And, you know, everybody kind of has that moment, Mark, that hooked them on horse racing. For me, it was the Traverse Stakes in 89 with Easy Goer, and I instantly fell in love. Do you remember your moment and what it was that hooked you on the sport?
You know, I don't know. I just loved horse racing from the start. You know, I grew up on a farm, and when everybody else was reading comic books, I was reading the racing form. But I guess, you know, the one thing that sticks in my mind was I can remember riding in a horse van with my father from Ocala to Churchill Downs to watch Secretariat run. And so that was very exciting. And then I can remember betting on Onion when he beat Secretariat. I think it may have been the Whitney or at Saratoga. I'm not sure the race, but I remember betting on Onion. Alan Jerkins trained him. But there's just so many things, you know, with horse racing. As my dad says, if it doesn't winny, I don't know a whole lot about it. So, you know, I was just horse racing.
You liked Onion to beat Secretariat?
Well, what can I say? I was 12.
Did you just like the name, or how'd you come up with it? Do you remember?
I don't know. I've always been kind of a guy for underdogs.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I liked the name. And I'd read so much about him. I mean, it's funny. Later on, I ended up training and working for a guy named Harry Mangurian, who owned the Boston Celtics. And he had a lot of good horses. And we'd be talking, and I'd tell him all about him. And he goes, "How would you know that? You must have been 12. And I said, "Well, I was reading the racing form." So I can remember as a little boy, the worst day of the week was Sunday because there was no racing form on Sunday.
Yeah, that's a downer. Terrible. Yeah, that's a downer.
So I'm pretty sick. Yes, I've been my entire life.
Well, you were like so many of the trainers that we talk with on this program. You were born into it, so to speak, with your dad being in the business. Talk about your dad and what his operation was like.
Well, my dad was kind of a strange deal for him. His father actually was a writer, wrote stories for the Indianapolis paper. But my grandfather loved horse racing, and he took my father to Keeneland a couple times, and it got my dad hooked on it. And I guess when I was about four, my dad decided my grandfather and grandmother had gotten in. They had sold fire engines. My father was helping sell fire engines at the time, and he just loved it, and he moved to Ocala and started breeding horses. And, you know, my dad was always kind of a small breeder, and so I grew up really around breeding more than anything. So I'm kind of unique. I know a lot about the breeding part, but to me, you know, the racing always is what excited me and what I wanted to pursue. And so I have a little bit of both.
How much of that knowledge of the breeding end of things helps you in your training operation now?
I think it helps a lot. You know, I also, for a long time, was general manager for Mangarian for Mockingbird Farm when we were the leading breeders in North America for 5 or 6 years. And I think it helps a lot. To me, what sets maybe me out a little more than for others is that it's, as I told my son Norman, who is one of my main assistants, it's the recruiting. It's going out and buying the horses, to me, is the most important part. Yep. You know, I've always had to kind of go out on my own for years. I would have to go buy cheap horses and you know, and I was very, very successful doing that. Now, of recent years, I've had the people now that have put out the money, and I've been able to go out and buy, you know, the horses that I really wanted to buy, and it's been working very well. So,
yeah, and
I think it's important.
Yeah, and in terms of your dad's operation and growing up, I believe, was it Cardinal Hill Farm? Was that the name of his farm?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Yeah, and you worked there for a few years anyways.
I did, and then, you know, my dad, when I was like 14 or 15, we used to train in the afternoon, so I would get out of school early, and I was running the training barn at 15 in charge of 50 horses or so.
Wow.
So, yes, I've been doing it my entire life.
Well, and it's paid off for you. I mentioned those nearly 1,500 winners. I think you're just shy of 1,500.
You know what? I didn't really know what the number was.
Yeah.
What happened? I went for about 10 years and stopped training. Where I was only training, you know, running maybe 20 horses a year in the eighties. I was a leading trainer in Kentucky but then I kind of got out of it, and I was the general manager for like I said, for Mangarian, and then got back into it. But I knew I had won my 1,000th race a few years ago, so but I really didn't know how many races we won.
Yeah, according to Equibase, they have you just shy of 1,500. I think it's like 1,490, so you're closing in quickly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're closing in quickly to that milestone.
Well, I learned something I didn't know.
What was the reasoning behind getting out? Was that by choice that you decided just to go back to the breeding end of things and work on the farm?
It was a couple things. It was just a wonderful opportunity. And it was, from a financial standpoint, I was able to make more money than I ever could have made training horses. So that was it. And you know what? I came across the man that believed in me and was willing to put up the money and do some things, and we were successful. And I maybe was, you know, I had started so young. I was 17 when I started training. I might have just been a little tired, too. Yeah.
Talking with trainer Mark Cassie here on Trainer Talk on the Final Furlong Show on the Horse Racing Radio Network. In terms of that, Mark, and being around the game, being around the breeding end of things, you had success pretty quickly when you started training. You won your first race in 1979 at Keeneland, I believe. What do you remember about that race in that moment?
I remember it very well. The horse's name was Joe's Coming, and the race was a mile and an eighth. It was for 5,000, and Jim McKnight rode the horse for me, and he was going to be second, but the rider of the horse that was on the lead pulled up the wrong pole.
Ooh.
He pulled up. you know, they have, Keeneland has two different wires. He pulled up at the first wire, and my rider, Jim McKnight, never stopped riding and won by a nose. And the other horse never, the boy stood up the 16th of a mile out and did it. So, I remember that well. And then, of course, I came over to Churchill Downs with three or four horses, and that was, for me, to be at Churchill Downs and training was just a dream come true.
Yeah, talk about some of the other notable horses, or it doesn't have to be notable, but more memorable horses that you've had the opportunity to be around throughout your career.
Oh, well, I guess, you know, Seely Hill, the filly that was Horse of the Year in Canada. She was second in the Breeders' Cup. In fact, I have her, her two-year-old's getting ready. It's about, maybe 10 days from making her first start. So I'm excited about that. Her name's Syllaby. She's by Distorted Humor. But, I've been around a lot of good horses. And I guess we've trained maybe five or six Canadian champions. I think the horse that we run on Saturday, Uncaptured, has the potential to possibly be one of the better horses that I've ever had. You know, he still has some stuff to prove. But.
Can you tell pretty early on in their career that this could be a special horse?
Pretty well from the beginning. When we had him down in Florida at the winter time, and we had broke him, and we had him over at OBS, and he trained quite well. But you just never know. You never know until they get to running and how they take to it. He's just been an absolute professional, done everything right. I didn't know what happened when he got beat in the gray. He just didn't come with his A game that day, and I don't know. But his last race in the Iroquois was pretty impressive to me.
It was very impressive. And do you notice certain qualities, Mark, that all good horses possess? Is there that one or two things that you can put your finger on and say, all the good ones, they all have this?
You know what? I don't think you can ever say that about any of them.
Yeah.
I find that the fillies, for the most part, some of the better fillies that I've had have been very nasty. I think that's one similarity in some of the better fillies. As far as the colts, no, I mean, I do believe, not always, but you know, so much of being successful and being a good horse is their attitude. You take, for instance, a horse like Perspective, who I'm not sitting here and saying he's the greatest horse, but he's won 7 out of 14 starts. I think we've ran him in 8 different racetracks this year, and he's won at maybe six different tracks.
I mean, yep.
He's just a professional. And, you like that in a horse. You like that in a horse. But to say there's one thing that stands out, I don't really think so.
You mentioned all the good fillies being a bit on the nasty side. Who was the nastiest very good filly that you ever trained?
Well, Seely Hill was pretty nasty.
Yeah.
I can remember... she had tried to attack me one time, and I wouldn't hardly go in the stall by myself with her. And I can remember after being made Horse of the Year in Canada, I went to visit her over at Whining Oaks, Melnick's farm, and she was out in the field by herself, and I walked out, and as I got to her, I thought, you know, this might not have been the smartest idea in the world to come out here in this paddock with her. And right when I did, I started backing up, and she started coming after me and trying to jump on me. And I said, okay, here, trainer killed by Horse of the Year. Yeah. But she's nasty. The filly that we ran in the Breeders' Cup this year that, just had a terrible start in Spring Venture.
Yeah.
She's very nasty too. She's very nasty.
Yeah, we talked before the Breeders' Cup. You had the two spring horses in the Breeders' Cup this year. It's somewhat tough to keep them straight, but you said they have totally opposite personalities, right?
They did, and then you have Spring in the Air, who ended up bleeding very badly. she, you know, she's sweet as can be. So, you know, there just really isn't, I don't know, there isn't really one thing that makes one horse great.
Yeah. Now, when you get time to kind of be alone and relax and think back on, I don't even know if you do this, but if you ever get a chance to look back on your career, what are some of the moments that really stand out to you, Mark?
I don't know. I really haven't, you know, I was very proud when we won the training trot title in the 80s at Churchill Downs.
Yep.
I was very proud of that. I was proud last year when we broke, we didn't really just even break it. We kind of demolished the record at Woodbine. So I was very proud of that. But you know what? I guess I would want other trainers to think whenever we run a horse, I want them to be able to look and say, well, you know, this horse is trained by Mark Cassie. We're going to have to beat him.
Yep.
And that's what I guess I strive for.
And you mentioned Woodbine and how you demolished the record at Woodbine. You've had a ton of success north of the border. Talk about the decision to go to Woodbine, bring horses up there. When did that happen and how did it all come about?
That happened in the mid-80s, mostly because I was just kind of tired of all the moving around that comes with the Kentucky circuit.
Yep.
And I went up there and liked the racing and stayed. So it's a wonderful place to race. But for us now, with all our young horses, everything, now we have to kind of venture out because we kind of feel like we've done pretty well what we can do there. But now we want to go out and, you know, we want to try to win the Kentucky Derbies and the Breeders' Cup. And to do that, you've got to spread out a little.
Yeah, talk about how your operation has changed, especially over the past several years. How have things developed and changed, and where does it stand now?
Well, you know, mostly we were going just to Toronto racing for their season, then shutting down for the wintertime. But in the last 4 or 5 years, if you're going to have, like I said, Kentucky Derby horses and Oaks horses, you have to race year-round. So it's kind of hard on us. It's hard on the family life because there isn't, you know, a lot of downtime. So we're racing now. We usually keep 30 or 40 horses down at, like, Gulfstream and Palmettos, and so that's different. Of course, I also have my son Norman, who he usually is wherever I'm not. We've also came back to kind of a homecoming. We've come back to Churchill Downs now. I guess this will be about our third year here. And, you know, so that's changed as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the family aspect. And, of course, Norman, a great kid, had a fun time getting to meet him at Breeders' Cup as well. He has been your right-hand man, so to speak, for quite some time now as your main assistant. His wife, Melanie, gallops horses as well, so it really is a family affair. Talk about that, Mark, and having one of your, I guess, seven kids involved in your operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and it's not, and my wife, too. My wife, she handles all the, you know, we have a very large business, and it's not just in the U.S., but it's in Canada, so she handles all that. Norman and Melanie usually go where I'm not going to be as much, and, of course, he's a Louisville boy, loves Kentucky, and so I do let him, you know, I do let him stay in Kentucky as much as I can, and, but it's nice, and I'll tell you what, it's nice to win, but when you're winning and you look around and there's nobody to share that with, it's just not the same as when you're winning and you have your family around and you can share it.
Yeah.
I know, you know, a few times to sit there and when we've won big races and to look over and to have Norman there, you know, means a lot. So, but we have my youngest, who's nine, Colby. He loves horse racing. It's funny, you go to school and the kids were talking about the Super Bowl you know, baseball, and he doesn't know anything about that, but he can tell you who won the Kentucky Derby. You know, he'll this is unbelievable. You know, doing the Zenyatta call, and then if he's ever doing something and it's close, Dan Lozelle at Woodbine always, if it's a close finish, he'll say it's picture time, and that's what Colby will. He'll be running in a race and it'll be close or something. And he'll say it's picture time. So, we only know one thing in our family, and it's horses.
Are any of the other kids involved as well?
Well, my second oldest son, he is a policeman actually in Louisville. And, he tried it for a little bit, but just didn't have the same love for it as Norman did. And my other kids are all pretty well still in school. My daughter does. She is the University of Toronto, and Camille, and she does work on our website and write stories. She's going to be a journalist and stuff. So she writes some. And then my other boys are not quite old enough yet, but I would see I have a 16-year-old Kyle. I could see him probably maybe falling in Norman's footsteps, because I'm sure it won't be long until Norman will be wanting to go out on his own. He had talked about it, but I think at this point in time, we have too many good horses. I don't think he wants to step away from those.
Yeah. Would you encourage him to do that?
I would. I would. I don't know that he's ready to do it right now. You know, I have to tell you, at this point, there's so much to horse training, and now, you know, it's different. And especially if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to operate on the scale that we operate on, it takes a lot of money, and it takes a lot of good people. And it's a team. I mean, you know, we have a huge team, and it takes a long time to, you know, to generate that team. And if Norman went out on his own, from a financial standpoint, I don't think he could get anywhere close to as well as he does, you know, working for Cassie Racing at this point in time. But I'm sure, you know, at some point in time he will.
Yeah,
when he does, you know, I'll be fine with it.
Yeah, I know if I asked him this next question that he would certainly say my dad, Mark. But in terms of your career, who is the person or people that had the biggest influence on you when you wanted to kind of get things started and go out on your own?
Well, you know, obviously in the beginning, my father. My father's yep. been a big influence from the beginning. And then the guy that really maybe helped me get towards the top was Harry Mangurian, because he saw my potential and let me go and do things. But that was more on the breeding side. And then I would say, if you're talking the last 10 years, Bill Farish was a guy that saw my potential, let me go out, and then, you know, be able to go out and buy some better horses. And then, without a doubt, of recent time, it's John Oxley. I mean, just the last 3 years, what he's let us go out and do. And I mean, I mean, hopefully with not, you know, as long as we don't have a lot of bad luck, you haven't seen anything yet. We, Mr. Oxley right now is the second leading owner in North America, just shy of $5 million. And you have to realize, we only have 2 4-year-olds. He owns 2 4-year-olds and about 23-year-olds. And then probably in the neighborhood of 25 2-year-olds. So it's been a building process. And now we have a really strong group of yearlings. And so I think once you see these three-year-olds become four-year-olds, and the two-year-olds become three-year-olds, and the yearlings become two-year-olds, he's going to have one heck of a racing stable. And, you know, we couldn't be anywhere close to where we are without him. You know, another guy that's been a big support of us over the years has been Eugene Melnick. I've trained a lot of really good horses for him as well.
And of course, all that.
I would say there's four. I would say there's four guys: my father, Harry Mangurian, Bill Farish, and then kind of it's kind of like climbing Mount Everest, right?
Yeah.
My dad helped me get to the part of, get started. Mr. Mangurian helped me get halfway up the mountain, and I think Bill and Mr. Oxley are going to help me get to the top.
And of course, the top, the first Saturday in May at Churchill Downs. And
that would be in my mind, the top.
Well, Mark, all the best on that journey, and hard to believe it's been 30 minutes already, my friend.
Well, as my Norman says, I can talk a lot, so it's not a problem.
Always the delight, and happy Thanksgiving to you and the family. We're going to look forward to catching up with you up the road, and good luck in the Clark Handicap
and
as well.
And give your regards to your wife, too, for us.
I will. Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Have a great evening, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Bye.
Great stuff. Trainer Mark Cassie, our special guest on the first half of Trainer Talk. Could have spent another half an hour with Mark easy. Al Stahl Jr. is coming up next. He'll be with us for the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. It comes up right after our next commercial break here on HRN Live.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full-card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
Introducing the Wizards Betting Window, a new wagering product available exclusively at DRF.com. The Wizards Betting Window takes the work out of wagering by giving you easy-to-use wagering recommendations for every race in the card at top tracks around the country. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the Betting Window, which suggests not only win-and-place bets, but also exotics including exactas, trifectas, daily doubles, and dime superfectas. And what really sets this product apart is the Betting Window Final Edition. Just download the Betting Window while you do your handicapping in advance, and then receive an update 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. You'll get all the latest scratches, current track and weather conditions, and late equipment changes. The Betting Window Final Edition will be delivered right to your inbox, so you can receive it anywhere. So use the Wizards' best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try it today. That's drf.com/wizbw for the Wizards Betting Window.
Don't miss your chance to participate in the biggest handicapping event of the year, the Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship, presented by Sovereign Stable and Treasure Island Las Vegas. To be eligible, simply log on to nhctour.com and register for just $50. Compete in handicapping tournaments throughout the country and win your seat at the NHC to be held January 13, 2013, Treasure Island in Las Vegas, where one lucky player will win an estimated $1 million and an Eclipse Award as Handicapper of the Year. Visit nhctour.com to see a complete tournament schedule and register today.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Welcome back to the Horse Racing Radio Network. Our Final Furlong Trainer Talk edition here on this Wednesday afternoon, a pre-Thanksgiving edition. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Lee Della Pina, our producer in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and ready for a big weekend of racing here on Thanksgiving weekend. Of course, you'll hear most of that with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Check it all out, horseracingradio.net, HRRNlive.com. And very thankful for our special guest taking the time to join us here on Trainer Talk today. Mark Cassie, a great interview with him in the first half of the show, and Al Stahl Jr. about to join us here momentarily. Don't forget, there is a podcast available, or will be a podcast available, on our site of all of our Trainer Talk shows shortly after this show is completed. Later on tomorrow, you'll be able to go listen to the show on iTunes and at horseracingradio.net at your leisure. So without further ado, let's get to the man who has trained more than 1,200 winners for his career. He just celebrated his 51st birthday on October 10th. A native of New Orleans, he is in the Bayou right now, and that's Al Stahl Jr., currently the leading trainer at Churchill Downs for their fall meet. Al, how's that sound?
Yeah, that's very unusual. It doesn't sound too bad, so we're just going to see if we can possibly hang on. But we're in very tough the next few days.
Yeah, congratulations on that. A big winner today, if I understand correctly. Applauding, winning off of an 11.5-month layoff.
Right. Applauding won her third race and her third start. And she didn't quite look like she did last year. She might have been a little bit rusty, but it might have been a good race under her belt. And we look forward to having a really good, winter season with her at Oaklawn Park.
An 11.5-month layoff, those are numbers that only Graham Motion and Michael Dickinson could even think about. And here you are, bringing her back off an 11.5-month layoff for the victory.
Yeah, well, it's easy when you have a loaded gun. So it wasn't as hard as it seems, but I'm very glad it's over with.
And you're in New Orleans right now, as I mentioned, getting ready for the opening of the Fairgrounds meet. I know that's always very special for you, being a native of New Orleans.
Oh, absolutely. I can't even tell you what it means to us. I can't tell you what year, how many years it's been, that we've been doing it like this, going to Fairgrounds on Thanksgiving Day and having Thanksgiving dinner Thursday evening. So it has absolutely just been a part of my life day one, and it's a tradition I don't ever plan on changing.
Well, Al, let's start from the beginning and tell us about how you became hooked on the sport of horse racing and talk about those early days and getting involved with the sport.
Well, my grandfather and father were involved. Everybody in New Orleans goes to the fairgrounds, so most everybody knows about racing one way or another, whether you're just there to gamble or socialize or, take it a step further. A lot of these, there's so many New Orleans guys between like myself and Tom Amos, and you go back to the Merrill Shares and Leo Gabriels, there's just a ton of city horsemen that have made great careers and really good horsemen, and it's all because of the fairgrounds. So my father and grandfather were involved, like I said earlier, owned horses, bred horses, and my father got involved with the political side of it with the Racing Commission, where he was a chairman for 20-some-odd years, and it's just something I've always done, and I just hooked up with when I got old enough. I was always at the barn, and Jack Vanberg was a trainer for them, John Oxley before that, and Frankie Brothers was an assistant trainer, Jack Vanberg, and that's the one that my father became very close with, and of course I did too. I mean, he's literally like family, Frankie is, and I just always hung around his barn, and then finally went out on my own in 91.
Was Frankie the person that had the greatest influence on your career in the early days?
Oh, yeah. He was the only person I ever worked for. I mean, I worked for Jack.
Yep.
The paycheck said Vanberg, but Frankie was the assistant. We'd see Jack once a month or once every 2 months or so. So it's been all Frankie. And what I know and don't know comes from him. So, but it was in retrospect, looking at his career and looking at the way things are going, it was it was definitely a Harvard type of education.
Yeah, he's a great guy to learn from. There's no doubt about that. One of the best in the game. Talk about some of the things that he taught you that you still incorporate into your operation today.
Well, I mean, you know, the first thing he taught you is you're on your own. You just, you know, look what you know and use your common sense. But, I mean, one of the main things is, you know, hot and cold streaks come in this game, and we don't do a whole lot of changing. We didn't start this year off well at all. First 3 months were actually terrible. And then from April 1st to present is just, I don't even know what the numbers might be, but I guarantee they're way off the charts, because I know we were, you know, really low. You know, we just kind of wrote it out. We didn't just change feed and change personnel. We didn't do any of that stuff. And sure enough, things just cycled around, and here we are today.
Yeah, talk
that's
about
the most important thing. You just stick with, you know, our program, so to speak. The one that he used to have, Vanberg used to have, M.H. Vanberg used to have, and now I've got. You know, there might be a tweak here and there over time, with mainly because of technology, you know, the type of feeds, and, you know, the science is more prevalent now than it was back in those days. And but other than that, it's really most probably the shed looks the same as it did in the 70s.
And Al, as you know, this is a sport, as you just kind of alluded to, that has the highest highs, the lowest lows. One minute you're winning the Breeders' Cup Classic with Blame, and then the next minute you're going through a tough stretch like you did at the beginning of this year. How do you deal with all the highs and lows and that roller coaster ride that comes with being a horse trainer?
Well, you just said I turned 51 this year, so things like that don't bother me. I've, you know, kind of been there and done that. So I'm not going to come home and kick the cat. I can guarantee you that. So, so everything, you know, I just go with it. It's no fun. It's aggravating. And, you know, the best thing to do is stay in contact with your owners and say, hey, you know, we're doing this, we're doing that. You have a horse that's doing good, but you got two horses that are doing bad, and we're going to try and say, you know, you just got to, you know, so you keep the business going, you got to keep those lines of communication open. You just don't want to go off on your own and feel sorry for yourself, then all of a sudden you start losing your business. So to keep the business going, just keep everybody happy and tell them the truth and say, hey, we're still working hard. Things just aren't clicking, but it'll come around, and sure enough, it does.
Now, I know one other thing that you're passionate about beside horse racing is your LSU Tigers, and you hold a degree in geology from LSU. Did you ever think about doing something other than being in the horse business?
Well, I did. I did. I worked in the oil field for about 3 years, at the end of college and out of college. I was a geologist, and when you're a young geologist, you spend a lot of time out on rigs. And I did that in the company I worked for. Was purchased by a bigger outfit in Texas, and they shut the New Orleans office down, and that's when I went back to track. So who knows, if they had to shut down, I still might have been in the oil business. So, but I was, you know, I was, when things got soft in oil business and the office shut down, I was lucky to have a crutch. You know, I went back to the racetrack where I'd worked during summers and the holidays, and kind of knew my way around. So I was fine. I felt bad for those other guys I worked with who, you know, 17 years of school down the drain type of thing. So,
yeah.
Anyway, but that's what happened. So I've seen both sides, and I'm never looked back. I've never thought, God, I wish I stayed in the oil field. So I'm fine with that.
Talking with trainer Al Stahl Jr. here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, our Wednesday feature event every single Wednesday, 6 to 7 Eastern, here on Sirius 93 XM 209. Al, Louisiana tends to be a hotbed of top personalities in our game. Let's say it that way. Top trainers, top jockeys, all coming out of Louisiana. Why has that been such a productive avenue for trainers and for jockeys over the course of history?
Well, just because there's just so much racing down here. There's, you know, at one time we had 5 or 6 tracks. No, well, not even counting the bush tracks. You know, there was 10 tracks of action. So everybody's been around the horses their whole life. Obviously the Cajun boys have made a name for themselves as riders and trainers, and a lot of the New Orleans guys. You know, I left like Wayne Catalano out also. He's a local here who's done unbelievably well from you know, growing up in the city of New Orleans. So it's just the fact that there's racing year round, and everybody seems to know about it, and you grow up with it, and and just get an early start, whether you're a glider or a trainer. And everybody kind of knows what horse is about at a very young age.
I can imagine it's got to be even more special for you winning a race at the fairgrounds probably than anywhere else. So, although the Breeders' Cup Classic was probably pretty special as well.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, there's obvious things at the fairgrounds. I mean, I've never done the big races here, the Oaks, the Handicap, or the Derby. We've run, I guess, seconds and thirds and many times, but we haven't done that. So obviously that would be something to do just for obvious reasons. So, but you know, those are things I don't worry about. You know, we've been to the mountaintop and we plan on going back again one day with some horse somehow. And we just keep doing what we do and things fall into place on their own.
Yeah, we'll talk about that blame effort defeating Zenyatta in 2010 here in just a minute. But I want to go back to 1991 for a minute when you first opened your public stable. You opened it, if I'm not mistaken, with one horse. Is that right?
Right. I had leaving the fairgrounds for, I guess that'd be the spring of 91. I went to Chicago just because Frankie was going to Chicago. And I didn't have any stalls, didn't even apply for stalls. I had a guy named Bobby Guidry, who's speaking of colorful figures, he's owned casinos and been to jail and done all kind of crazy things. down from Louisiana, he's a West Bank guy on the other side of the river from New Orleans. And he gave me one horse, and Frankie let me borrow a stall, and we just kind of had it in his barn. And I still work for Frankie. And then I got another horse or two for, I remember one of them was for my father and some of his partners. And we just kind of went from one to two to three to six. And then we got to Keeneland, and it ended up being 15. And then I got weaned from Frankie. He went to Florida. I went to the fairgrounds, and I think Mervin Munez, just because I've known him literally my whole life, he was a racing secretary. I mean, I deserved about four stalls, and he gave me 20. And we got him filled up pretty quick, and we had a really good first meet, and we were off and running from there.
Who was your first winner?
Well, the first winner was a filly named Scottish Fantasy. It was owned by Al Sr. and Larry Israel and guys from New Orleans, and it was Arlington in August of 91. It was a filly by Exuberant. Tom Amos had trained. I bought the horse at a sale, and Tom trained it for a while, and then I went out on my own, and I scooped her away from Tom. So
wow.
I fired Tom Amos in the first month of my career. How about that?
You know you've made it when.
That's right. That's exactly right. Right.
Well, fast forward, you go from Scottish Fantasy, you end up with Blame in 2010. So from your first winner to winning the Breeders' Cup Classic at Churchill, defeating Zenyatta. Walk back through that campaign and through that moment at Churchill Downs for me.
Well, to take you back a little bit earlier than that, that's another Frankie Brothers moment. I mean, my real connection with Claiborne Farm came via him. He was a private trainer for him, and just the fact that I was hanging around him all the time, I got to know Seth Hancock. And Seth Hancock knew my grandfather and father because, we bred, they breed a mare too back in the old days. Everybody wanted to get to the Claiborne studs, and they did too, So there was a little bit of connection there. And so Frankie told me, he said, you and Seth will get along fine. He said, the only thing I can tell you is just keep doing what you're doing, and Claiborne Farm is due. And boy, was he right. Because in the second crop, that I really had for him was two-year-olds. There was Blame. And no, there was the first crop. It was the first crop, and there was Blame in there. And we just started him twice as a two-year-old. He was a good two-year-old. He ran a turf way just because we didn't have a place to run him in September. I didn't take him to Saratoga, and he broke his maiden Keeneland. And, we had absolute Louisiana Derby dreams on our mind, and he got a quarter crack. So we grew it out and fixed it all up and, did all that kind of stuff. And he made his first start in Churchill in the next spring, and he ran a really good third. And then after that, he just took off. He won that 9-2 condition, and he won the curling, and believe it or not, he lost the Super Derby, which, we won the Super Derby 2 out of 3 years in a row. And the one we lost, we could have done it 3 years in a row, but the one that lost was Blame. So it's a crazy game. That horse for Regal Ransom, Sheikh Mohammed, got an easy lead, and we kind of fell out of it, and he closed, and he just didn't get there. So But once you won the Clark, you know, we're going back 2 years to the day. No, 3 years to the day. He started this Friday. And we knew we had something when he won the Clark as a three-year-old. So we literally marked the calendar of 2010 with the Breeders' Cup being at Churchill and backed up from there. And, you know, one of the most rare things that could ever happen in this game is he hit, virtually every mark, whether it be a gallop, a work, a race, and it just everything fell right into place. And with him just accidentally stubbing his toe in the Jockey Club Gold Cup under unusual, you know, the hurricane came through there and track was really packed down and pure speed, and he just couldn't catch Ben New York bred Spitestown horse Steve. I can't come with his name right now.
Yeah.
But that might have been a blessing in disguise because he didn't really fire that hard that day, and he was loaded for bear on Breeders' Cup Saturday.
Well, he was loaded for bear, and it always amazes me, Al, and we've been hosting these trainer talk shows now for the past couple of months or so, and every time that we talk with trainers, it amazes me that you can remember, and a lot of trainers are like this, you can remember every detail about a horse's campaign, a horse like Blame. You can remember, and even other horses that weren't the quality of Blame, you can go back through and you can recall almost every single race that they competed in. It's amazing.
Oh, I could tell you the times just works, just about, you know, because that's human nature. I mean, it's like when the Saints were on their Super Bowl run, everybody in the city knew every player on the team. And now, you know, they're coming back and they're doing well this year, but they weren't 13-0 like they were that year. And you know, I guarantee you people don't know as much about the team as they did back then. It's just when something gets more and more important, that just calls you to focus in on it. So that's the way horse people are in general, and horse trainers are no different.
Didn't I tell you that if you're coming on the show, we can't talk about any other team but the Pittsburgh Steelers?
Yeah, no, I know. Well, I'm worried about you. I was thinking about you when you called it, when you texted me earlier today. I was looking at your injuries, and I was kind of being between Denver and Denver and New England. I'm worried about you and the Ravens, because I thought it'd be the opposite way, but it looks like the injuries might be putting a hammer on y'all. So I'm hoping. I love the Steelers. I hope that I'm wishing the best for you.
Yeah,
because you know the Saints are, the NFL marketing people have. With the popularity that the Saints have gotten over the past few years, he said the team that they have passed up are the Steelers, because the Steelers are one of those teams that everybody followed and liked, and they still do, but the Saints have kind of taken their place since the 2010 season. And that, I mean, I would have never thought that in a million years, but that's what one of those Sharpies told me about the Saints.
Wow. Al Stahl Jr., our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. If you can't tell, Al, passionate about his New Orleans Saints as well. Is it safe to say, Al, that outside of horse racing, that would be your next passion?
Well, I mean, we've got family and we've got, golf and, everything's balanced out. I mean, I'm just, it's like anything else. I feel like I'm 100 years old, but I've been going to Saints games since 1967. So, I mean, we've been going to LSU games before I-10 was built. And we should take the back roads to those country towns up the Mississippi River. So, that's something that's officially considered in your blood.
How many games will you make it to now per year?
LSU, not that many, one or two. And even though I've got season tickets, I just kind of let my friends and brother's friends kind of use them. But that's something you don't ever want to give up, because you'll never get back on that list. But I catch every Saints game when we're in town. I went to the Eagle game on Monday night, and I went to the Atlanta game on Sunday, and then I will be in that dome, which is going to be absolutely wild for the 49er game, especially if it's a late post time, a late kickoff, I should say, and that place will be absolutely rolling on Thanksgiving weekend. I can guarantee you that.
Do you get a big crossover when the Saints are in town and Fairgrounds is running? Do you tend to get a bigger crowd at Fairgrounds because of that?
No, the opposite. Fairgrounds. I talked to Tim, Brian, and Eric Hollister today about that. They're loaded up Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday at the Fairgrounds will be an absolute ghost town. So they know that's coming, and that's just the way it is. They're not gonna buck religion.
Well, it should be a lot of fun. Good luck to your Saints the rest of the way. Talk about your family for a minute, Alan. How much they meant to you, the support that they've shown you over the years. throughout everything that you've been through, the highs, the lows. Talk about the family and how they play into everything.
Well, I mean, you know, my wife, Nicole, and we have two kids, and right now they're young enough to where we have, you know, two different schools in two different cities, so that's working out well. And but, you know, there's stress involved when you're talking about when you're talking about packing things up. I mean, we slept in our beds Sunday night in Louisville, Kentucky, and now we're sitting here at our house in New Orleans, kind of like nothing ever happened, really. We've got it down to an art, and we get, you know, we get everything moved in and moved out, and you gotta bite the bullet and work very hard, and so you get a lot of normalcy going, and we'll be ready to go tomorrow and for Thanksgiving Day, and the kids will start school on Monday, so we'll just, it'll be like a totally normal life. I just, you know, once you do it for a while, you kind of get used to it.
No bats in that house, right?
Yeah, no bats in New Orleans. There's not much bats down here.
You have to tell me that story again. That was a great story.
Well, our daughter was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, was just born, and we were, you know, like in those old houses in Saratoga, one of those rentals, and, you know, it'd be my second time having a bat, you know, in the middle of the night, they somehow get in through the smallest crack, and you can hear them bouncing off the wall, and that's not exactly a fun, a good feeling. And so, the next night he's even worse because you're worried about, is he back or what's he doing? And then we called some crazy guy, Adirondack Dundee, to flush him out of there. And, he looked like Bill Murray from Caddyshack with the boots on and the hat and tied around his head. And he said, I did, you know, I think you might have bit your daughter. She weighed about 7 pounds at the time. We're like, what? She needs to get vaccinated. So we're like, no, we're not going to do that. We're still worried. Maybe this guy's right. And so it was a little hairy for a while, but we actually moved out of that house into a different place that we've been in ever since. So bats are no fun. I can tell you that. They scare you to death. They scare me to death.
Man, it says something for having a one-horse stable, right? Like back in the early days. Now you're traveling all over the place, and you're dealing with all those kind of things too.
Right. Well, it's just part of it. You just got to have the right attitude. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, like when I worked in Oldfield, I had a boss that taught me more in 3 years than I've learned from most anybody. And he said, you know, because we used to have to work on the weekends and New Year's and Christmas because those oil wells don't sleep either. You know, it's 24/7 out there. And he said, well, you know, you could be a shoe clerk, and you wouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff. And that I think about that literally all the time. When you get a little down and out, and you're dragging, and I counted my phone calls this afternoon just because I thought I had a real busy day, and there was like 94 phone calls, and the first one was at 5:37 a.m. until, you know, I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah.
You know? So, like I said, you could do something different, sell shoes for a living, and I don't think you'd have as much fun and excitement.
Well, at least I gave you a reason, something to look forward to at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. We're good. We're fine. Look, most phone calls are some are better than others, and yours are good.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, I told you we weren't going to talk a whole lot about the horses that you have in training currently, but we did have a caller call into our call-in show earlier this afternoon, and they asked about number 5, Cease, who's going to go postward for, of course, Claiborne Farm in the Clark Handicap on Friday. Fill me in on how Cease is doing, how he's coming up to the race.
Very good. Very, very excited to run Cease Friday. Had a good race in Chicago. Should have won it. Had a questionable trip. We thought he was the best horse, and we just thought he got a ton out of that race. I mean, he's an old campaigner, so we just kind of kept him fresh, kept him going forward. And he's made every breeze. He's made everything like we want him to, and I think he'll be just really ready to run. I think the race might set up properly for him with Shackelford in there, and hopefully it's his day. He's the kind of horse that's due. You know, he's had some awkward trips in various races. Woodward, he kind of had to stop and change lanes and things like that, and I think he's sitting on a really good one. I really do.
Do you ever find yourself, when you get a horse like Cease in your stable, again, the same connections as Blame, do you ever find yourself thinking, man, is this the next one? Is he the next Blame?
Well, you know, I'm very realistic about things. I doubt there'll be another Blaine, but, you know, Cease is just a grinding gelding. So he's a gelding. So he's a whole different, you know, breed of cat. But we love him nonetheless. And like I said, we try to keep him to where he's competitive and not overmatch him. And, we just feel like this is a shot worth taking on Friday.
Talk a little bit more about that relationship with Claiborne and why that works so well. I know you got into it a little bit earlier talking about Frankie Brothers and him kind of being their longtime trainer and then you taking over. But why does that relationship seem to work for you with Claiborne?
Well, it's Claiborne, obviously they have good horses. That's the greatest thing about it. But, you know, they're concerned about the right things just like I am. They're, you know, character's very important to them. And I feel like I get up every day and work hard and try and do the right thing by my horses and my owners and my family and things like that. And I think Seth kind of respects that, and he feels the same way about the way he lives his life, and they're big into that, and so that creates a natural comfort zone, and then all of a sudden there come these horses wrapped up in Tiffany boxes every year after year, and you just try and make the most of it, and I fully understand how he thinks, and he certainly understands how I think, and I know what he wants out of his boy horses, and certainly I know what he wants out of his fillies, and it just works out. So I'm super lucky to be in the spot. There's there's a bunch of people who could do the same thing I'm doing with these kind of horses. Just keep it going, do the best we can on a daily basis.
Talking with Al Stahl Jr. here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Al, just a couple minutes left to wrap this one up before we have to say goodbye, but I want to thank you for taking the time to be here again tonight. Always a lot of fun to catch up with you and talk about so many of these outstanding horses. Is there a horse, when you look back on your career and you have a horse that sticks out to you and you say, man, I wish I could have done this, or I wish I could have done that, or I'd love to have this horse back because I think this horse could have been really special. They just never caught a break. Is there a horse like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's plenty. Well, I'm dealing with one right now. And, there's a horse named Bind, who's a pulpit horse of Claiborne's, who, you know, ran 108.4 his first time out, won by 10 or 12 lengths, and ran a 1.25 on the sheets first time out, the lowest number in the history of rag numbers for a first-time starter. And that was in, I don't know when it was, but, I mean, that was in March of 2010. So he got a fracture and got screws, and he had a bunch of things go wrong with him. But he's back, and at the fairgrounds he breathes 5/8 this morning. He breathes a half gallop about 5/8 this morning, and you know he's a horse that you talk about a replacement for Blaine. He, without question, has the talent to do it. Whether the soundness and the luck and all those things will go for him, but he's one that. You know, if he doesn't finish his career as a stakes winner, that'd be one that'll clearly got away.
Al Stahl Jr., ladies and gentlemen. Al, as always, thank you so much for taking the time here tonight. It's always fun to talk with you and been a lot of fun to hear your history, your background, and your story.
Okay, Mike, thank you. I appreciate it. Anytime. And tell your wife hello. You all have a good Thanksgiving.
I will. Happy Thanksgiving to you and the family as well. And I'll see you down there at the fairgrounds or maybe over at Churchill here this weekend.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
All right, buddy.
Bye.
Al Stahl Jr. Great stuff from Al. Man, a podcast of this show will be available for you by tomorrow on our website, horseracingradio.net. And we want to thank Mark Cassie as well for taking the time to join us in the first half hour of the show. If you missed any portion, visit our website, horseracingradio.net, for a podcast of this show. That'll about do it for us here this afternoon on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We are back. Don't forget, no HRN Live tomorrow. Back on Friday, 3 to 7 Eastern Time, our weekend handicapping preview, taking a look at all the big stakes races. The final furlong show on Friday, plus we'll have great racing action from Churchill, Aqueduct, and Hollywood. Our equine forum show, 8 to 10 Eastern on Saturday morning as well. Check it all out, horseracingradio.net. For Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We will talk to you next time, Friday. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.